local station board and our national boards are really ball and chain around the necks of Pacifica stations like KPFK.
On this episode of Radio Survivor, there's another crisis at a Pacifica station. Matthew Lasar explains why we should care.
Jennifer Waits remembers an impassioned advocate for college media.
And it's a Lasar twofer when Matthew dives into the radio origins of cartoon chicken Foghorn Leghorn.
I'm a chicken. Rooster, that is.
I'm looking forward to that one. My name is Eric Klein. I'm one of your hosts.
My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm the other host. Before we get started, I just wanted listeners to know that there will be a grassroots radio conference happening this year, hosted by WLPP, a low-power FM station in Palinville, which is upstate New York. And the GRC is happening September 24th through 27th. Next week, I'll be talking with WLPP General Manager Catherine Platine and Program Director Victoria Whitaker, along with Station Startup Specialist Donna DiBianco, to learn more about this year's Grassroots Radio Conference and also to learn about this great host station, which only went on the air 1 month ago. In the meantime, you can learn more about the Grassroots Radio Conference at grc2015.net. That's grc2015.net. We have some news about the Pacifica Network. In particular, its Los Angeles station, KPFK. Now, Eric, you're going to fill us in a little bit on what has happened.
Yeah, and so at the moment, there's a lot of attention in the Pacifica community, and there's not a lot of reporting on what's going on. But there's been, I think it's clear that we can say that there's been some very significant staff cuts to KPFK. We know about this because, the morning show host, Uprising is the show, Sonali Kolhatkar is the host, went on the air to discuss the issues, which is, sort of the strategy of last resort for most, radio professionals, that they don't want to air their dirty laundry in their time slots. So you know that things. I know Sonali's reputation as a coworker. I guess I should put that out there at the very beginning of this segment that I worked at KPFA Pacifica Station. I've been impacted by staff reductions in my past at that station, and I've participated, although somewhat reluctantly, in some of the Pacifica radio station political struggles that have been ongoing. And so that's where I'm coming from. And we're talking about this because KPFK is a big station in the Pacifica Network. And this is a real significant moment in its history.
Yeah, and you have this piece of tape of Sonali on air.
Yes.
And this, if I understand correctly, was actually during a pledge break.
Yes.
In which normally she's asking listeners for their donations to help keep KPFK on the air, KPFK being a community station and a non-commercial station at that.
Yeah, so at the conclusion of her 8 a.m. drive time morning show program on Friday, August 21st, Sonali took to the airwaves with this message.
Hi, I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host of Uprising, and I apologize for interrupting today's program. I hope you've been enjoying the show for the past week or so, and in general, if you've been a listener for many years, I hope this is a program you value, because in a few short weeks, this program is likely going to be cut in some way or another, because my hours are being cut, as are the hours of all full-time paid staff at KPFK. This is not a joke. I'm not making this up. I'm not doing it to scare you. On Monday of this week, KPFK management informed all staff at a staff meeting that the hours of all full-time staff would be cut down to half-time. How I would produce, my crew and I would produce a show on 5 days a week on half the time that we do now, and now we do it by the skin of our teeth, you know, usually work long hours to do it. How we would do it with half-time pay, I have no idea, and this is to come down within less than 2 weeks. Early September is when this is supposed to go into effect. How the station will function with our paid staff being paid at half-time is something that is just beyond my comprehension. These these decisions are being made on the basis of not enough money coming in. The station is more than $300,000 in debt, and the managers calculate that the cutting of full-time paid staff to half-time for 4 months will save $180,000. How we are supposed to survive financially, individually, you know, find part-time work with less than 2 weeks is also something that is quite unfathomable to me. If you think the station is worth saving, maybe you'll flood the airwaves, flood our phone lines, that is right now at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. This is the last day of an exhausting five-week drive, and we never imagined this drive would be so long. I've never seen such a drive, a fun drive with so few dollars pouring in. I don't know what that's an indication of, other than listener fatigue and other, you know, other certain issues that that are hard to pinpoint. One of the issues that is easy to pinpoint is that our local station board and our national boards are really ball and chain around the necks of Pacifica stations like KPFK, where members who have most of them completely expired their terms have continued being seated because there's just not enough quorum, because listeners just don't care enough about voting in 24 members of the public and staff into positions to democratically run a radio station, because listeners are interested. You are interested in good programming as well. That is all you should be interested in. Good, solid programming, unlike anything you hear anywhere else. And so the current board structure as it is defined has really decimated KPFK, not come up with any means of fundraising off air, which is what their job really is or should be, instead focused on creating instability at the stations, trying to fulfill some ideological fantasy of running a radio station on volunteer help alone, and really what I call the Walmartization of Pacifica. You know, reduce pay so much, starve people out so much that they will either leave so we don't get severance and then get replaced by volunteers, or simply work fewer hours and do other part-time jobs and get replaced by volunteers. And we were told in letters handed to us informing us of our pay cuts that we could apply for the California Workshare Program. What does Walmart, I mean, what do, you know, what else can you compare that to but what Walmart is doing, where employees are paid so little that they are essentially, the company relies on government assistance to enable their staffers to survive. And that's what KPFK has come to right now. It's really pathetic. It's a sad state of affairs. I'm speaking to you from the heart. None of this has been sanctioned by management. Perhaps I'll get into trouble for saying this, like Ian Masters did. Ian, by the way, is not on the air this week because he has been suspended for speaking out about issues internally. That's all I'll say about that. Maybe I won't be on the air on Monday. Maybe I'll be suspended too. I don't know. But the fact is, what is happening inside KPFK is a brutal tragedy right now. The station is falling apart. We are in trouble. You are the owners of the station. You need to find a way to save the station in the short term by pouring money into it so that staff cuts are less justifiable. In the long term, by doing away with the current board structure and replacing it with something much more reasonable and something much more practical. 818-985-KPFK is the phone number to call. 818.
So that was Sonali Kalhotkar, a KPFK staff member and the host of Uprising, the 8 a.m., the daily 8 a.m. program there that airs in the Los Angeles area.
And to get some sense of context on why this is important for community radio in the United States and why it's something we think we should report on and pay attention to, we're joined by our colleague, Matthew Lassar. Thank you, Matthew.
Hi, guys.
So, Matthew, I mean, trying to kind of, you know, quickly get a sense for this, one of the things that Sonali was talking about is a board system, right? And I think she mentioned 24 board members. You know, I think many people are often familiar with the fact that a community radio station is usually a nonprofit corporation, so there usually is a board of directors as required by law, I think, in pretty much every state of the union,
yes.
You know, which is supposed to take care of the many legal and financial affairs. It sounds like 24 members sounds like a fairly big board, and she mentioned that these are all elected by the members of the station. So these are listener members. Is this correct? Am I getting this right?
Actually, the 24 is the small number. when you think about the entire Pacifica network and the size of its governance system. I think it's important for us at this point to basically frame what Pacifica is. It's basically five. A big part of it is five listener-supported radio stations that have been around since 1949 when KPFA in Berkeley was created. Then came KPFK in Los Angeles in 1959. Then WBAI was acquired in New York City in 1960. KPFT in Houston in 1970 and WPFW in Washington, D.C. in 1977. Each one of these radio stations has a 24-member local station board. And those boards pick around 20 members to sit on the Pacifica National Board, which also has a couple of at-large members and also has somebody who's represents the affiliates who pick up Pacifica programming at other community radio stations. And the local station board members also sit on national governance committees and have a lot to say about budgets and hiring. So that, in fact, what you have at Pacifica as a whole is a national board system that involves approximately 123 people.
All elected.
All elected. That doesn't include the community advisory boards that are required by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which are separate entities. You add another 40 people for that, approximately. The five stations have, it's hard to get the number, but often, you know, between 8 and 10 people who are on their community advisory board. And these people are all elected by the listener subscribers. Only about 10% of the listener subscribers actually are involved in these elections, which take place 2 out of every 3 years to vote for all of these people.
And those 10% you mentioned, is you say only 10% are involved. Is that because only 10% are permitted, or is that
no?
Sort
it's because
of
only 10% ever
rate?
Bother to vote. It's because only 10% will ever bother to vote.
And that's because at any given station they have like how many different positions they need to vote for, and how many
they
candidates?
Usually need to vote for about half of the local station boards. And most of the listener subscribers don't vote because they find these elections to be incomprehensible, frankly. KPFK, there's a 10% minimum for the election to be certified. In the last election, KPFK didn't even make certification. It couldn't even get 10% of the listener subscribers to vote.
Oh, that's what Sonali was talking about.
Yeah, that's what Sonali was talking about. So if you take it as a whole, I mean, if you really want to go through the total absurdity, you have a governance system, which, you know, is about 70,000 subscribers across the Pacifica network, about 10% of them vote. So that's another 7,000 people. So we're talking about a governance system that involves directly or indirectly about 7,200 people.
And I'm trying to wrap my head around this because I've always known about there's a scale, but and I know you've written about it at Radio Survivor, Matthew, and I often forget about the actual scope, because when you talk about a governance board of more than 100 people, that's the United States Senate. For all intents and purposes,
it is too many people.
so as we take this, so I understand that this developed in part, it was sort of a radical reaction to fears that the Pacifica National Board was becoming sort of more corporatized, looking more like a corporate entity. Now about 15 years ago, correct?
I'll give you the thumbnail here if you want it. Here,
yeah,
let me try and give you the thumbnail. You know, historically, Pacifica never really could figure out whether it was a network of community access stations or a professional operation trying to compete with other networks like NPR. And, you know, for the purposes of discussion, let's call them door number one and door number two. Door number one is community access. Door number two is professionalization. In the 1990s, Pacifica more or less picked door number two, professionalism. And it really transformed the stations. It ran strip programming, hired a lot more people, really focused on national programming. And it did okay with this. I mean, by 1996, 1997, it launched Democracy Now!, which was a very successful show. But the friction caused by this process, especially the dismissal of a lot of volunteer programmers across the network, created enormous polarization across the organization. And by 1999, two people came in to run Pacifica or were brought in to run Pacifica who really didn't know what they were doing. One of them was Mary Frances Berry, Professor Mary Frances Berry of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Lynn Chadwick, who had long been involved with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And in a fight with KPFA management, Lynn Chadwick, to the shock of everyone, this is 1999, shut KPFA down. She literally shut down the station. She piped in programming from elsewhere. She put armed guards inside the station. This was 1999. The board also proposed, or members of the board also proposed, selling KPFA and WBAI. And the city of Berkeley, which is the broadcasting, the town to which KPFA broadcasts, went into a state of siege over this. I was there. It was unforgettable. At one point, the chief of police of Berkeley went to the station and said, "If we can't protect the rest of the city of Berkeley if this goes on,
were shut down.
The streets were shut down everywhere around. You know, there were people who were shutting down the local freeways over KPFA, and." In the chaos that ensued, the advocates for door number one, community access, declared, you see, professionalism was always a mistake. And they took over and they all piled into the governance process. And the more of them got involved, the bigger the governance planning process got. And you got this gigantic board system that we have now, which is, in my opinion, an enormous overreaction to what had happened earlier. The Pacifica organization lurched from the extreme centralization that Mary Frances Berry and Lynn Chadwick wanted to this vast decentralization that we have now. Now, it should be said that this board system has been not only very dysfunctional, it's been very expensive for Pacifica Radio. Since the democratization of Pacifica Radio, which happened about a dozen years ago, I calculate that Pacifica's boards and Pacifica's election system has cost the organization $3,191,000. And that doesn't include legal costs, hundreds of thousands of dollars to all kinds of lawsuits, because Pacifica Radio is a lawsuit machine at this point.
Right, and, because many of these struggles end up being resolved in the courts, or at least with lawyers under threat to sue, or in out of court proceedings. Right. And
struggles
like
between
that.
Board members,
or, struggles or between board members. I mean, you followed Summer Reese. What happened with Summer Reese, Paul? You know, you wrote about that, which basically, you know, there was an enormous battle over the fact that she was dismissed by an incoming
board.
This
was the executive director of the Pacifica Network in a few years previous.
Yeah, no, last summer. And she and her followers literally bivouacked themselves inside the Pacifica National Office in Berkeley, and it had to be resolved via a court telling her to get the heck out. This stuff is very expensive. We're talking about, you know, constant attempts to throw people off the board, recall campaigns, all kinds of crazy stuff.
And from within the stations, I think it's also important to note, especially people who have experience working in radio stations might be able to empathize or at least know what this means. We experienced a leadership vacuum under this system where nobody held the job of executive director of the network for very long. It was a very short lifespan for anybody who held that position. They were either forced out or they quit just over and over and over again. And the same went for management of the stations, that nobody held those jobs for very long under this regime.
Part of the problem is the size of the boards. Part of the problem is that when you have elected boards, why are people going to run on these boards? They're going to run to influence programming, right? I mean, that's basically the draw for people. So, of course, they all come to the boards with very different ideas about programming. And the next thing you know, they're involved in enormous power struggles. These elections rob boards of their ability to effectively help the stations, especially with what the most important thing they can do is, which is capital campaigns. Yeah. KPFT in particular, here's some good news for Pacifica. KPFT has finally raised the final $20,000 via an Indiegogo campaign to fix its transmitter. It's going to get a brand new solid state transmitter.
And that's its Houston station.
That's a Houston station. But it took them almost 3 years to raise the money for that. And one of the reasons for that is that its local station board is just as polarized as all the other local station boards. Most of the people who run for the boards do so because they want to influence programming. And so the result is that you get these ideologues, and many of them still believe that basically what should happen is that the organization be an all-volunteer organization. For lots of people, not everybody on the boards, but for lots of people on the boards, poverty is a virtue. They think that what should happen is that you go to all-volunteer radio shows, and this solves the problem. And I personally don't think that that's going to solve the problem, because I think that, especially when it comes to public affairs programming, you need professional people to be able to do these things, and they need to be paid if you want to be competitive with other radio stations. But that's what they think. And much of the fighting that takes place now still focuses on the age-old professionalism versus community access dilemma that Pacifica has always faced. The problem is that the organization cannot afford these huge boards any longer. It can't afford this huge dysfunctional system. One of the biggest problems is that lots of people, as you both know, I wrote a piece in The Nation magazine about this which was published some months ago. And I got a lot of responses. And what was very clear to me is that lots of people, unfortunately, really sort of have come to experience this level of chaos at Pacifica Radio as normal. Lots of people have sort of gotten used to it. Oh, yes, it's another Pacifica fight. But the problem is that this doesn't just affect Pacifica Radio. It also affects the rest of community radio. Take, for example, Free Speech Radio News, which is an enormous resource for community radio, not just at Pacifica, but elsewhere. It's been hobbled by the fact that Pacifica owes it lots of money, and Pacifica can't pay it. And one of the reasons it can't pay it is because it's spending all this money on governance.
I should mention that Free Speech Radio News was my first job in radio back in around 2004.
So yeah, and let's telescope out a little bit here, Matthew, because I will admit to myself often having sort of come to the conclusion that yes, the chaos is the way at Pacifica, and which then leads to apathy. It leads to, well, I mean, why should I care? And often, you know, here on the podcast or on Radio Survivor, you know, it often leads to the question of, well, why should we even cover it? You know, and it is often a question because for me, sometimes thinking about it journalistically, you wonder whether this is sort of, like reality television. Are we covering it for shock value or because there's drama and people like drama? Or are we covering it and talking about it because there are larger implications? And so you mentioned one implication, which is the fact that Pacifica has been a longtime program producer and supplier to community radio stations, Free Speech Radio News being a program that it financed and supplied for quite some time.
And Democracy that aired Now. Free Speech Radio News aired on multiple radio right. stations around the country and the world.
Yeah.
And was available online as a podcast.
And
it's,
Democracy
it's retrenchment
Now.
Has been an enormous loss.
And so maybe paint a little fuller picture of how else – you know, what happens at Pacifica has this broader impact on community radio in the United States and around the world.
Well, you also have the Pacifica Affiliate Service. And, you know, the Pacifica Affiliate Service, which is run by Ursula Ruttenberg, you know, does its best to get by given the internal situation at Pacifica Radio. But think how much more it could do along with the Pacifica Archives. Think how much more the Pacifica Archives, which is deprived of a lot of needed funding from Pacifica.
And tell us what the Pacifica Archives are.
We also want to mention that the Pacifica Archives is experiencing a lot of similar staffing reductions during this current Pacifica monetary crisis. So they're going through the same thing that KPFK and KPFA is going through.
Yeah, so can you tell us what the Pacifica Archives are so people get an understanding of why
that's
important?
The Pacifica Archives is a huge archive of many, many programs that have been broadcast in Pacifica Radio going all the way back to 1949 when KPFA went on the air. And they provide a whole lot of really interesting programming. They have their own website. You can search it. You can get all kinds of programming. I recently, in fact, on one of my Lazar's Letters on Radio episodes recently was about the new Women's History segment of the Pacifica Archives, which is all this programming of famous feminists from the 1960s and 1970s. It's really kind of a treasure trove of Pacifica programming, and it's available to everybody across the United States. This and the Pacifica Affiliate Service could do much more if the organization had more money and if the organization wasn't mired in internal chaos on a day-to-day basis. And we all know here that now more than ever, community radio needs some kind of network for sharing of programming, especially when you have all of these many, many low-power FM radio stations that are just emerging. I mean, this is the time when we need more. We need a functional network to help these radio stations get content. Instead, what's at the center of the community radio movement in the United States is the Pacifica Foundation and its dysfunctional governance process.
And Pacifica has, my understanding, resources for that. There's they have their own satellite system, yeah, which allows a live interconnect for live programming.
The old KU.
Between stations, which in the past has provided really great alternative coverage to like Iran-Contra hearings and other governmental hearings, along with providing great live programming like Democracy Now! And then they have AudioPort, which Eric just mentioned, which is an online repository similar to the Public Radio Exchange, but again, open to Pacifica Network affiliate stations. And I understand if you're a Pacifica affiliate member, it's cheaper. Like a lot, much of what Pacifica has been able to provide is a lot of that kind of infrastructure, which an NPR affiliate station has access to, but it's for substantially less money than it would cost to be a member of NPR or Public Radio International, these other public radio systems. Is that about right, Matthew?
Yes. Pacifica is sitting on a very significant resource, a resource that could be much more, could provide much more to the community radio movement in the United States than it does now. The reason it doesn't at this point, the reason why, you know, much of it is sort of at death's door at this point, is basically because, to a large extent, because there's no leadership at Pacifica Radio. One of the reasons why there's no leadership is because you have this just sort of this vast mess, which is its governance system. And you know, lots of people say, you know, well, it's just the way it is. It's always been that way at Pacifica. And I respond, this is not acceptable. It's not acceptable. This situation is not acceptable. What happened with that standoff at Berkeley last year with Summer Reese was not acceptable. The complete collapse of WBAI in New York City, or the near complete collapse of WBAI, in which almost all the paid staff was dismissed several years ago, is not acceptable. The fact that it's taken so long for KPFT to get on that transmitter is not acceptable. This is not normal. You know, having board meetings at which, you know, some years ago, a governance committee on the Pacifica National Board accused Democracy Now! of taking CIA money because it wouldn't talk about 9/11 the way some board member thought it should talk about it. That's not acceptable. These things are not acceptable, and they need to change.
And Matthew, I mean, one thing I want to also kind of bring up here when we think about the larger impacts, I think the infrastructure issue is significant because it is an infrastructure that is difficult to build and is already exists. It's difficult to recreate. But also the fact that as this sort of foundational institution in community radio, it sets an example. And I know from firsthand experience and also from having talked to many, many community radio people around the country, what happens in the leadership at Pacifica, the Pacifica board and elsewhere, it happens in other stations as well, where you have boards that are filled with people whose primary interest is to influence programming or support their favorite programming instead of behaving as a typical nonprofit board member does, which is to assist with capital fundraising and governance issues of maybe a higher sort, where it's often the legal status of the corporation and in terms of really dealing with management issues. I see that happen as well. And for me, I often look at it with low power FM in particular, that stations are coming together and coming online right now, and they're going to they're facing some of these questions of how they should constitute themselves, how should their boards of directors run, what should the relationship be between management, their boards of directors, and who's on air? Should they be principally public access, or should they be principally of a more public service institution? And you know, what I often want to say to these stations is to consider these questions very carefully and not reflexively, and not to assume that there is only one or two models of community radio based upon either some legacy stations that have been around for 25 or 30 years, or based upon, you know, KPFA, KPFK, or the Pacifica stations. Not because they're necessarily wrong, but because there are only a couple of ways of doing it, and we can see through the lens of history and the type of work that Matthew has done in his books, but also through talking with people who've been through these struggles at various stations, that there have been outcomes that often imperil your actual mission as a station, the actual programming and what you actually do on air, at the expense of fighting battles over governance or other ideological battles in your boards of directors and in your management.
All right, so Matthew, we've sufficiently laid out the significant problems facing the Pacifica Radio Network. What do you recommend? How do we move forward?
Well, I think that this is a really difficult problem because, without getting into the technicalities of Pacifica's bylaws, the organization makes it really, really difficult to amend its bylaws. It's really hard to do it. So that it'll be a tremendous challenge to change Pacifica's bylaws. However, I think that a lot of pressure needs to come on Pacifica from the outside of the organization, saying that this is just not acceptable. And I think that people need to recalibrate their thinking about Pacifica, and they need to start being cynical about Pacifica and thinking, well, you know, this is just the way it is. It's the way it's always been. It's the way it will always be. And recognize that this is not acceptable, that it's really having a consequence, that it's really having bad consequences, not just for Pacifica, but for community radio in general. And I think that the community radio movement as a whole needs to recognize that. And I think it needs to say whoever seems to be in charge at Pacifica that this has to stop now, and the internal change has to begin now.
If you don't mind me asking, I know one thing that's being floated and has always been floated. Well, it's the question of, is it appropriate to give Pacifica stations money during these difficult times, or is it appropriate to withhold the money so that they get a message?
Well, what I would really like to see is not a withholding of money, but a withholding of votes. I really, there used to be this old joke in the 1960s, supposing they gave an election and no one came. I always thought that was rather inappropriate for U.S. democracy in general. But for Pacifica, I would say that it's very appropriate. If you're out there and you're considering voting in these elections, I'd appreciate it if you didn't. I won't. These elections are an enormous waste of time and money for Pacifica. And if all of them don't reach the 10% certification, Pacifica is having an election now. If all of them don't reach the 10% certification, it sends an enormous message to the leadership of the organization that no one's interested in this charade anymore. So while I wouldn't recommend not giving money, I would recommend not participating in this nonsensical and wasteful exercise in pseudo-democracy, which is the Pacifica governance system.
Matthew, thank you very much for sharing and shedding some light on this situation. We agree that this is important to community radio, and we'll continue to cover it. And certainly, we'll have links in our show notes, both for some of your previous work and documentation on Pacifica. And of course, people should read both of your books that we'll link to in the show notes as well, which really give a really great history and overview, both of the history of the network and then the later struggles, which we sort of alluded to earlier. And of course, Matthew, people will get to hear you again on the show. So in Lessard's letter on radio.
Thanks, Matthew. Up next, we have College Radio Watch with Jennifer Waits.
So, Paul, this week I have kind of some surprising college radio news. We found out that a college radio license that had been previously sold is now up for sale again. And this is happening in Houston, Texas. On August 20th, we heard that Houston Public Media is going to be selling off the license for KUHA, which is 91.7 FM in Houston, known as Classical 91.7. And then it will move its classical music programming to HD radio through one of its other frequencies that it holds in Houston. And Radio Survivor readers will recall that this frequency, 91.7 in Houston, used to be the frequency for the Rice University station, KTRU. And there was a whole lot of backlash and protest when it was announced back in 2010 that Rice was planning to sell off the frequency for that very powerful license in Houston. And then in 2011, the sale went through and KTRU moved coincidentally to online streaming and HD radio. It was sold for $9.5 million. And as of yet, we don't know how much Houston Public Media is planning to sell the license for today, but back 5 years ago, it was sold for $9.5 million, and it's a 50,000-watt frequency in Houston.
Wow.
So it's, yeah. So it's definitely a weird, bittersweet moment for all of the people that were fighting to keep that frequency on campus at Rice to hear that 5 years later, it's back up for sale again. Is pretty disappointing.
And back 5 years ago, what was the university's justification for selling its frequency?
Well, I went back to look and see what the party line on it was at the time. And here's a quote from their FAQs that Rice had put out on their media relations website back then. They said the economic downturn and the resulting losses to Rice's endowment led to careful evaluation of how the university prioritizes and spends its resources, both its annual operating budget and its assets. In KTRU's case, it became clear that the radio tower and 50,000-watt frequency served very few people. Because of internet technology, KTRU can continue to serve its audience through ktru.org, while the university applies the proceeds from the sale to programs and services that will serve more people and help achieve the university's aspirations.
So since then, what's happened with KTRU? Has it continued to thrive? Has it declined? Or is it sort of situation normal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's continued to thrive. And, since broadcasting online and over HD, and then it took advantage of the low power FM application window and it applied for a low power FM license, which it recently got earlier this year. So it's making plans to begin broadcasting over low power FM. So, you know, it's doing fine. It, you know, kind of re-emerged and just kind of continued on, but not for lack of protest. You know, people were very upset about losing the powerful frequency.
Right. 50,000 watts is a big, big signal. I think the most powerful college station I was involved with ever had about 7,000 watts, which was considered a big college signal at the time. So 50,000 is pretty huge. And who's buying the station or who may buy the station as it is now KUHA?
We don't know. So they're just saying that they are planning to sell it, but they haven't said what the price would be. They haven't said if they have any suitors for the station at this point. So we don't know. So originally, it's University of Houston that runs this public radio group in Houston. And they originally purchased the license so that they could have one station for news, one station for classical music. So we've seen that a lot where public radio groups like to have segmented stations. So that was the original plan. And now they're just going to move classical to the HD channel for the other station that they own.
Right.
But we don't know we don't know who might be interested in the frequency. You know, of course, you know, there are little rumors like, oh, they should just give the license back to Rice. You know, who knows? And who knows what the price would be 5 years later.
One thing that occurs to me is that there are very few buyers out there for non-commercial spectrum who can afford millions of dollars like that. So we definitely know, as we've seen in the college radio space, there are some public radio organizations that often are able to assemble that type of capital, often with the support of an organization called Public Radio Capital, which helps to help stations to raise money in all sorts of ways for all sorts of reasons. Besides that, the other well-heeled groups tend to be large Christian broadcasters who are able to spend that kind of money. Outside of that, I'm not sure who else there would be, and I don't know what public broadcasters there would be in the Houston, Texas area, or who want to move into the Houston, Texas area, who could spend that kind of money.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the speculation I've heard so far has been about religious broadcasters. So you're absolutely right. You know, big sales like this tend to be religious broadcasters and public radio groups, which are often at other colleges and universities. You know, there are also cases where groups decide to just donate a license to somebody. So there have been those occurrences, you know, typically not when it's such a valuable license, but it's always nice when that happens.
And then you have a little bit of sad news for us.
Well, yeah, really sad news, actually. I was really shocked to hear a few days ago about the death of Dan Reimold. And he ran the blog College Media Matters, which is an incredible source for information about student media. And he was also the assistant journalism professor at St. Joseph's University and was the advisor for their student newspaper, The Hawk. So Dan Reimold, you know, died unexpectedly on Friday, August 21st, and he was only 34 years old. Mm-hmm. And details are kind of sketchy. It sounds like he had some sort of accident at home, and friends were concerned because they'd tried to reach him for a few days and hadn't been able to reach him. And then I guess he was discovered. So we don't really know all the details, but it was very unexpected. You know, he had plans. If you go on his blog, there were plans for webinars coming up this week where he was going to talk about issues related to student media. I mean, he was really one of these rare people that devoted himself to, or he devoted his work and his writing to evangelizing student media, in particular student press. So he was primarily a print journalist and also had a blog that you can find on the College Media Matters website where he talks about issues in student media. And I met him virtually. He sent me an email back in 2010 when he was putting together a list of some of the people that mattered in college media in that year. And so he introduced himself and asked for advice, and he characterized himself in that email as, he said, "I'm an impassioned college journalism scholar." And I really connected with him because I felt like we were doing similar things. You know, I try to evangelize the importance of college radio, and he was doing the same thing to an even greater degree for mostly student press. And he also covered the world of college radio on his blog as well. So he would write about when there were news stories related to things happening at college radio stations. And I would also turn to him when something came up that I felt was sort of an intersection between college radio and student rights. Mm-hmm. He was really an advocate for the First Amendment and freedom of speech, which gets a little tricky with college radio. We don't have the same sorts of protections that student journalists have because we have all these things like FCC regulations too. But I really like to get his point of view when there were controversies that kind of intersected those two areas. I always appreciated his insights. So it's just a huge tragedy to hear about somebody who is really fighting the good fight. You know, his life ended way too soon. So I just wanted to make sure that we share that news with people who listen to the Radio Survivor podcast, because he was definitely a friend of Radio Survivor and a fan of all sorts of student media.
Yeah, it's a real loss. And he was doing very important work, you know, in advocating for student media and student journalism and their freedom of speech, because it's not only important for, I think, the students themselves, both the ones who are reporting and their fellow students who benefit from that reportage. But of course, you know, today's student journalists are tomorrow's professional journalists, right? And training a generation to be inquisitive and to not be afraid to dig in and not be afraid to speak up is vital ultimately for our democracy, for us to have good journalism and news as they become, you know, tomorrow's newspaper reporters, magazine editors, bloggers, you know, radio journalists, television journalists, and on. So yes, it's a real loss, and certainly my condolences go out to his family and his friends and his students, who I'm sure are definitely missing him.
Yeah, I definitely saw some things, you know, on Twitter and on the page for the student newspaper, The Hawk, that he advised. And, you know, he led his students to some really amazing awards recently. So I can only imagine what an inspirational advisor he was. So it's got to be horrible to start the year.
Yeah.
Losing your advisor. So yes, I share in passing along condolences to his family and friends and students and everybody he touched in the world of student media. I found something on his website that I wanted to share too. He had posted a 6-word memoir. And so his 6-word memoir is dream big, create, learn, teach, repeat.
Wow. Well, I guess we can close with that. Words both to keep in mind and to remember, Dan by. Jennifer, thanks for updating us this week.
Yeah, thanks.
Dream big, create, learn, teach, repeat. Sounds good. So the first part of that college radio watch, I'm wondering, the selling of college radio stations to classical music stations, is that a trend? And is that a continuing trend, or are we done seeing that in this country?
I don't think I can say. I mean, it has happened.
Yeah, I first became aware of it at KUSF, the really funky and special college radio station in San Francisco that was sold out from under the volunteers at that station to a classical music station. And then because of this show, I hear about it more than I've heard about it twice, I believe, in College Radio Watch. And this story happened to be about something that happened 5 years ago.
Right. So I think to call it a trend would be to overstate it, because it's a few instances and
right.
There are hundreds of college radio stations out there. And certainly some of college radio signals are more valuable than others. A 50,000 watt signal stands apart as being a particularly powerful and valuable slice of spectrum. There are very few college stations that have that kind of power. Nevertheless, it is something which I think any college radio advocate, whether they are someone who is a college student or faculty member or someone who is a college radio advisor, should pay attention to and understand what the potential market value of their station is, because whether it sounds like it's a contradiction in terms or not, there is a market in non-commercial radio licenses, and it's often when that market value is high that a college or university is tempted to plug up short-term financial holes with what can be a seven-figure payday.
A nice windfall for cash-strapped education institutions. I also wonder, this might be something to bring Jennifer in on later, and we should put a bookmark in this, but I wonder if people around these college radio stations could start now documenting their value, not their monetary value, but their education value, so that they have something, a nice thick dossier to point to in emergencies.
Yeah. In fact, that's something which both Jennifer and I have written about at radiosurvivor.com. And it probably is a great thing to bring up more specifically and bring Jennifer in on that conversation because myself, I am a former college radio advisor. And I was lucky to have a supervisor, an advocate in the school in which the station was situated, who understood that need clearly, instructed me as the advisor to be sure that I kept it in mind and to actively make sure that the educational and campus service value of the station was well understood and known, in addition to encouraging the students to be sure to be advocates for it and to put their efforts into it, which they did. And I think they don't really need to be encouraged much to do so, so much as often need a little bit of guidance and help in doing so. But certainly that was made very clear to me. And it's something which, you know, I'm not going to say that that hasn't happened in these cases.
Right.
You know. Right. But that at the same time, you know, what develops is a picture of warning signs. Again, I think we should bring in Jennifer, that often a station needs to look for. And one excuse is often percentage of student involvement versus people who are non-students being involved. And as well, you know, service to campus in ways that are not only documentable, but often attestable by third parties, whether that third party might be your campus newspaper, might be faculty organizations on campus that have been able to forge partnerships and have benefited from your station. I think those are all things. And the great thing about a lot of these ideas is that they extend equally well to any non-commercial station. If you're a community station, having a dossier of ways in which your station has done things for the community, which help to both, I think, burnish its reputation with listeners and your most immediate member supporters, but also amongst other organizations in your city or town, government officials and such, who could be your ally and might even be contributors to your cause down the road. I think that there are principles which kind of carry across all of non-commercial radio, which are easy to forget because just the daily process of broadcasting can be so energy consumptive and exciting, but also tiring. They're great things to keep in mind.
I think it'd also be valuable just as a document to remind even staff members at the station that this is one of the reasons we're here. And maybe a new person comes on the station and works there for a year or two, but is unaware of that sort of history. If it happened 10 years ago, this is, and it might give them a good idea. Like, we did this 12 years ago. Maybe we could do it again today.
Right. When morale gets a little low because the phones aren't ringing during pledge drive or, you know, something goes wrong, equipment dies, and you're having difficulty funding it, you say, well, this is why we do it. Here's some great things.
Institutional memory.
Yeah, that we did. And I think these are great points for any college radio station, but certainly I think any non-commercial station, if you can dedicate a little bit of time and resource to documenting these great things and your record of service and the kudos that you get, that will be in the best interest of your organization.
Neat. And maybe possibly a topic for further discussion on future podcasts.
Absolutely.
Or future episodes of this radio program.
Indeed. And if you have other ideas or other things you'd like to hear about, or you have some comments about this, you'd like to share your own ideas and experiences, things that have worked, things that you've seen out there that you think are great and more people should know about it, let us know. podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Well, up next, it's a special edition of the Radio Survivor Show because we've heard from him once today, but we're going to hear from Matthew Lazar again with Lazar's Letter on Radio.
What a day for tramping through the woods. I'm a chicken. Rooster, that is.
Don't give me that. You're not a chicken.
What am I then, boy?
You're a loudmouth schnook.
If you are my age or older, or maybe just a YouTube addict, you recognize that as the voice of cartoon character Foghorn Leghorn, basically a great big southern drawling chicken who starred in Warner Brothers' Looney Tunes episodes from 1946 through 1963. This is Matthew Lessar with another Lessar's Letter on Radio, and here's something that maybe you didn't know about Foghorn Leghorn. He got his start on radio. Voice of Foghorn Leghorn first identifiably surfaced on The Fred Allen Show, a beloved national comedy program that reached its height during the Second World War. The show included a feature called Allen's Alley, in which Fred and friends paid visits to various stereotypical ethnic characters, a Jewish housewife, a New England farmer, an Irish songwriting duo, and United States Senator Beauregard Claghorn.
The senator's home.
I'll knock and see what happens.
Somebody, I say, somebody knocks.
Yes, I know.
Claghorn's the name. Senator Claghorn, that is.
I know you're from the South.
When I'm in New York, I'll never go to the Yankee Stadium.
Now, wait a minute.
I won't even go to see the Giants unless the South Pole pitches.
Well, look,
I refuse to watch the Dodgers unless Dixie Walker's playing.
Now, wait a minute.
Stop interrupting. Where's your manners?
Manners? I have no manners.
Try listening. You might learn something.
Listen, all I'll ever learn.
Your tongue's wagging like a blind dog's tail in a meat market.
Skillfully portrayed by comedian Kenny Del Mar, Fred Allen's Senator Claghorn served as a gentle critique of the South, a region with whose provincialism the increasingly liberal North had become impatient. But the character became so popular that Del Mar wound up starring in two largely forgotten Hollywood movies featuring Claghorn, the most famous being the 1946 film It's a Joke, Son, in which the homespun protagonist outsmarts a northern-controlled state political machine in a bid for the U.S. Senate. Now he became a kind of Mr. South goes to Washington populist hero. Here's Claghorn making his maiden speech.
Now about this election business, I'm warning you that if I'm elected, I won't allow any streetcars down here to go north. People that live up that way won't be able to get home.
Holy God.
Of course, they can always come to my place, Claghorn Manor, and live in style and comfort. Southern comfort, that is.
Listen, the audience wants
and they'll eat southern fish, too, yeah. Heel. That's Lee spelled backwards. That's a joke, son. Here I am hitting the jackpot. I'm busting scenes tonight.
Busting my heart. Now, holy God.
Matter, you want to say something, son?
Did I want to say?
Well, go right ahead and say it. It's a free country. At least the southern part of it is.
Well, all I want to say is...
The Looney Tunes Foghorn Leghorn character showed up that same year, largely denuded of the regional politics that earlier scriptwriters had either critiqued or celebrated. YouTube is full of cherished collections of Foghorn Leghorn quips and comebacks, but perhaps you'll agree with me that they've lost some of their luster.
I don't think this boy's got all his marbles. Shakes his head when he means yes, nods when he means no. Hey, that's a joke, son. Hey, boy, pay attention to me when I'm talking to you. This'll be more fun than a barrel of half-witted monkeys. Pay attention, boy. Say, what's the big idea bashing me in the bazooka that away, boy? His muscles are as soggy as a used tea bag. Listen to me, boy. Pay attention when I'm talking.
The last Warner Brothers Foghorn feature appeared in 1963. I suspect that by then Warner Brothers sensed that in America, poised to pass civil rights laws, had run out of patience not only with the White South, but with a cartoon character who liked saying the word boy with more than a little too much gusto. Foghorn Leghorn started out as a critique of the White South, then a champion of it, then a caricature of the region. You'd only know this if you knew that the once famous chicken started his career in radio. This is Matthew Lessar for the Radio Survivor podcast with one more clip from the senator.
Tell me, Senator, are you behind this victory loan?
I overdone it, son. I can't go back home.
You can't go south?
I told my constituents to buy bonds. Buy victory bonds, I said.
I see.
Our army has won the war, I said.
Good.
Our army is coming home victorious, I said.
Well, why can't you go back down south, Senator?
They thought I meant the Confederate Army.
Oh.
Come on.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Claghorn.
Thank you, Matthew, for that that commentary. That was really fun. It's sort of I didn't know that, so that's the best kind of segment for me when I get to learn something. It reminds me of how I was sort of unaware as a child in the 80s that so much of what was going on television before my eyes had its start on radio, that radio was before TV as the mass medium.
And especially as a dramatic medium.
Yeah. And now we have a similar strange moment where there are some podcasts sneaking onto television, and some people might not be aware, but most people probably are. That
you'd be surprised, because you know I work for Earwolf, which produces Comedy Bang Bang, and so sometimes I'll meet people and sort of, as you always do, explain where you work, and they'll be aware of Comedy Bang Bang, the television show, and have no idea that it has a podcast origin, because at least in that show, there's no sort of podcast device. Like, they don't do any podcasting on the show.
No.
It's the same format.
It was just like a workshop or a laboratory for the material that ends up on cable television, started as this radio program that's got archived.
Sort of, yeah, exactly. Though both are still going on. Whereas, yeah. Like, I think Marin's show, the conceit is he's a podcaster in the show.
Okay, so you would be aware.
So you would probably – well, you might not even be aware that it really exists. I could see – you could still think it's just a fictional – presentation of, you know, of just like WKRP in Cincinnati was not a real radio station.
Mm-hmm.
You could think that Marin is just a TV podcaster. The Les Nessman of his times.
I don't know who that is, Paul.
Oh, Eric, you're killing me. you're going to get some penance, which is to go on YouTube and watch WKRP in Cincinnati.
I'm aware of that show. I just don't know who Les Nessman is.
Les Nessman was the intrepid news broadcaster.
All I know about WKRP in Cincinnati is that they couldn't release it on DVD because the music licensing was too expensive.
And now it's out.
They got rights most to all of the songs.
Most of it has been restored, and it is out.
We just really did lay bare, though, the very small generational difference between you and I, that I didn't know the name of a character in a TV show that I vaguely remember.
Pivotal. Everything I knew about radio when I was like 9 years old came from WKRP in Cincinnati, and I think that, people should go back and watch it. Not only because it's fun, but it gives you this sort of snapshot of what radio was like in the late 70s and early 80s, that there were local stations, first of all, that were locally owned, that had live DJs, that had usually had a news person,
right?
A paid news person.
Even though it was a rock
Right.
type place.
Even if it was a rock station or adult contemporary station who did real newscasts.
Huh.
Like, although, you know, much of it is exaggerated for effect, the sort of the fundamentals of WKRP were actually true to reality.
Well, that's funny because just now in the interstitial moments of this episode, I think we've sniffed out two great segment ideas for future episodes. Because I'd like to dig more deeply into this WKRP in Cincinnati.
I'll have to see if it's still available. The Paley Center in L.A. had a WKRP reunion about a year ago.
A streaming video.
Which they webcast. I watched it. And it was a lot of fun. And so if it's still out there, we'll link to it in the show notes at radiosurvivor.com/podcast so people can also see what we're talking about. And maybe I'm sure John Anderson, Professor John Anderson at Brooklyn College and DIYmedia.net, a friend of the show, he'd love to come on. He is also a WKRP super fan who could talk more than I can about how it reflected real radio in a lot of ways and was sort of a bellwether of an ethos, I think.
Wow. Well, then I can't wait.
We've opened a kettle of fish here that you will come to regret forever, Eric Klein.
No, it'll be fine. I can talk about TV on a podcast all day long.
I think that wraps things up. We really appreciate you staying tuned and listening to our show. You heard that we're at radiosurvivor.com. That's, of course, where you go for news every single weekday about college radio, low power FM, community radio, and lots of things that affect our ability to make, create, and listen to great radio. If you could, we'd love it if you would leave us a review on iTunes. Click some stars or write something down. It helps other people find the show. We'd love to sort of expand the number of people who can learn about great radio. As well, you know, this is a non-commercial operation. So if you could spare a couple of dollars every month to help us do what we do across the board here, we'd really appreciate it. You could do so through Patreon, which allows people to give a monthly little stipend to help their favorite projects along. You can pledge as little as $1, but that adds up when lots of people do it. $1 a month helps us move along. At $5 a month, we have bonus content, which is from the show, as well as from radiosurvivor.com. Right now, we've got a bonus interview with the folks from Bainbridge Community Broadcasting, talking about some of their community outreach efforts and discussing also why they do or do not stream live. It's a really interesting part of the conversation. We didn't have time for the show. That's patreon.com/radiosurvivor. We're also going to start giving our Patreon subscribers early previews of some of our segments, such as College Radio Watch and Lasar's Letter on Radio. So please go patreon.com/radiosurvivor. And of course, all comments, send them to podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Right. And if there was something on this show that made you sit up and speak out loud, wishing that we could hear your opinions, and we couldn't because right now it's a one-way form of communication, change that. Send us your opinions about what we have just been speaking on today's program. Email us a voice memo that you record on your phone, or send us that regular old email text version to podcast@radiosurvivor.com. We'd really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Paul.